Well, thanks very much for having me. It's been a lovely conference so far, and I always enjoy coming to Perimeter Institute because, well, for many reasons, but one of them is, actually reminds me of my grandmother. So back when Perimeter Institute was first getting built, you know, I was a student interested in science and physics, and my grandmother would always send me newspaper clippings of this new thing that was happening in Waterloo. She was from Sudbury. And she didn't understand anything that was going to be happening inside of the building or what people were going to be working on, but she was very excited about it. And she felt that it was important for me to know about this. So I would get all these newspaper clippings. I'd, you know, see the building as it was going up. So it's nice to come to PI so I can think about her. So today I'm going to talk about a little work that we've been doing in the group focused on using deep learning to try and sort of expand and improve on a method called density functional theory. And so I just wanted to start off by highlighting the people in the group that really did the work here. So one of whom you've already heard from earlier this week, that's Kevin Richko. So he did most of the work in the data set generation in the analysis and on the actual application of the DFT. And then Irene, Kyle, and Adam were really the team that made the extensive deep neural networks that I'll talk a little bit about, made them a reality. So, you know, to people in the group, it's not surprising to know, or in this room rather, that, you know, if you want to do sort of machine learning and quantum design, then it's probably a good idea to think about the Schrodinger equation. And so, you know, all of us here somehow in our lives, you know, solve this or measure the effects of the Schrodinger equation through our work. And you know, it's one of these things where when I give this, it's funny how you get different audiences, right? So I've given talks like this in public series, and you kind of throw this thing up and people gasp. But I always tell them, it's like, actually, it looks very terrifying, but it's actually not that bad. It's just a partial differential equation. We just have this way of sort of making it look scary. And I think where part of the problem comes for people is that there's so many variables kicking around. And so I remember as an undergrad student kind of looking at this thing and thinking, oh my gosh, what do I do with this? And shortly thereafter in grad school, I found out that there's actually a way you can just avoid the whole thing. And that's actually what density functional theory is. So DFT is a theoretical framework which was developed in the 1960s. And it basically, in practical terms, are sort of two key proofs, two key papers that define DFT. So the first one is what's known as Homberg-Cohn theorem. So Homberg-Cohn theorem, so that's sort of on the right side of the screen here. This is a proof that shows that there's a one-to-one mapping between the external confining potential. So, you know, if you have sort of nuclei, that would be basically the potential that you have from the protons within the system plus some external field. There's a one-to-one mapping between that potential and the many-body and the ground state electron density. So there's this sort of Richard Martin has a very nice treatment of this, and sort of I really like this graphic because basically what he shows is that you say, okay, so we have the external potential. This is sort of what you would put into your Schrodinger equation. This gives rise to some many-body wave function, you know, which has potentially or has a continuum rather than excited states. And then of all the possible states of the wave function, we know that one of them is going to be the ground state. And if we trace out the density, we can get something called the ground state electron density. And as it turns out, because you have this one-to-one mapping, what it means is that in practice, all the information which is encoded into this thing actually also exists in this thing. So this was sort of like a kind of a nice simple proof that a first-year grad student can do, and this kind of felt good when I did this. I was like, okay, I kind of understand where this is going now. But of course, you realize that just because this existence or this information completeness thing exists between the ground state density and psi, it doesn't mean that you can necessarily do anything with. There's no prescription on how to extract the information. So the information is encoded into the density. We just don't know how to get it. And so then 2 years later, there was a second paper by Cohn Sham. And they said, well, what about if we can sort of imagine a non-interacting world, which happens to have the same density as that of the interacting world? right? So this is the one over here. And they say in that non-interacting world, we'd actually be able to very simply solve for psi, right? You know, this is sort of first year quantum mechanics. And if we could, if they had the same density, then the information that we could extract from this guy would be equivalent to this. And so it feels like there's some funny business going on. You say, well, you can't just say we're going to go from non-interacting to interacting or vice versa without paying a price. And so really what they're doing is they're sort of hiding it under the rug with this term here. So you're no longer solving this system in the presence of the external field in the nuclei. Now we have this term which we call V-effective. And so V-effective is what's what basically maps these two systems from one to the other. And so they say that, you know, from going from the interacting case to the non-interacting case, now you need to find this effective potential that would somehow do the mapping so that your you know, non-interacting particles would give rise to the same density as the interacting case over on the other side. Now, what's nice, though, is that you can sort of convince yourself that V effective and V external are connected to one another, and in fact, they are functionals of the density itself. And we can actually make approximations to this term. And this is basically what resulted in the next 50 or 60 years of work. People have made different approximations to the what's called the so-called exchange correlation potential. And when they do that, and actually try it for real systems, we find that the results are excellent. So here I'm plotting just some comparisons. So these are predicted versus true for some training set. So the y-axis are the calculated bond lengths with some different functionals, so B3-lip and a range-separated functional. And then on the x-axis, I'm showing here the experimental bond length, or in the case on the right, the zero-point energy. And in, as you guys know, that if you're on this line of y equals x, then you're doing a pretty good job. So there are many tests that have been done over the years of DFT showing that it's not perfect. But when you look at a broad class of materials, so things like metals, semiconductors, molecules, and so on, it does a pretty good job. Where pretty good means it's good enough to sort of interpret experiments. You can start to design new molecules, can be quite helpful. Okay. And if you didn't already know this in terms of the ubiquity of it, so here are some fun facts. About 15%, roughly, of worldwide time on the big clusters, so things like, you know, a Compute Canada machine or the DOE machines, about 15% of the time is literally spent on one piece of DFT software alone called VASP. And there are actually many pieces of software which are running density functional theory. So if you are ever, you know, sitting in a cluster and you're complaining about all the people who are ahead of you in the queue and are sucking up all the resources, there is a good chance that that person is calculating electronic structure theory using density functional theory. And it's not an exaggeration to say that, you know, millions and millions and millions of CPU hours every month, not just every year, every month, are spent within things like the DOE, DOD, and across the OECD national lab system. So there is a huge amount of computation which goes into density functional theory. And it produces a lot of science. So last year, there were more than 30,000 papers which use density functional theory. Not just citations, but actually like papers that used it. So it's big. And so what is it? It's something that density functional theory, basically, it maps the ground state electron density to physical observables of the system. But the problem is that we can't read the map. We know the mapping exists, but we don't know how to exactly interpret it. So now I want to, let's rewind a little bit. I have this bad habit where I don't know if my students know this or not, but I tend to goof off a lot at work. And so I have, over the years, I've developed like this coping strategy where I try and do something useful as I'm goofing off. And one of the things that I realized was sort of useful was to try and make scientific visualizations. So, you know, back when I was a young grad student intern at Livermore Lab, and I was working on my first project, which is metallic hydrogen, I still had the goof-off habit there, and so I would make visualizations of the data that I was producing during that summer. And so my computer is like full of pictures like this, if I go back through the archives. And so what you're looking at, this is the result of a DFT calculation, but now I'm visualizing it. And so what can you see here? So you have two protons, which have been made hilariously large, just because I sort of wanted to be able to see them. But then the rest of this is meaningful. So these are isosurfaces of the ground state electron density. And I was trying to be artistic at the time. And so I said, well, the low density region, I'm going to kind of make it flat. And then there's this kind of mesh thing here in the middle, right? So this is supposed to be a covalent wand. This is one way that you can visualize these results. Or, of course, another way that you can do it is you still take the same volumetric data. And now I'm going to do a vertical slice. And as you go far away from the molecule, you can see there's a lower concentration of electron. As you get sort of closer in between, you can see something that looks like a covalent bond. They are absolutely not to scale. No, this is because otherwise this plot was less fun. And so the young grad student of me sort of, pretty much, yeah. I kind of wanted to see little balls, yeah. So the questions that we ask of these calculations are things like, you know, what wavelengths of light does this thing absorb? What are the forces that are acting on these not-to-scale protons? And you know, how much energy does it take to add or remove an electron? And invariably, because we are running these computations within a digital computer, we have some sort of grid or basis which we are sort of storing these results on, and we're trying to extract insight. So because this is a quantum and machine learning conference, then I don't have to introduce MNIST to you. But for the people that wandered into the room accidentally, we'll just remind ourselves, what is this? This is a training set which was put together by the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, which is a sister organization to the lab that I work at. And what it is, it's basically a whole bunch of labeled data of handwritten characters. So this is the hello world of machine computer vision. And so if we remind ourselves, what is MNIST? It's basically, it is a data set of characters, like here's the number 5, where you have signal on some grid. So in this case, it's 0 to 255, because it's grayscale. And what we want to do with machine learning is we want to be able to take this grid of numbers, and I want to pass it through some box where the box returns a one-hot vector. So in this case, this is a 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. This is a 5. And if I show it a 7, it should give me this vector. A 0 would give me something like this. And because it's a classification problem, this needs to work for many instances within the class. And so as you know, there's lots of ways that you can solve the image recognition problem, and one that's become basically predominant in the past decade are based on convolutional neural networks. So this is an early convolutional neural net that was actually used on MNIST by LeCun and Bengio back in 98. There have been significant developments. So this is ImageNet from 2012, and of course now ResNet has sort of started to dominate these field. But what was so powerful about this form of network topology was the fact that you're taking these convolutions. So you can see this here on the far left. So this is the case of the letter A. And what we have is a convolution, so it'll have some kernel size, like say 3 by 5, or 3 by 3, or 5 by 5. And basically what these things are, and I'll show you a little bit more detail, but they have the ability to pick up on sort of local features within your data set, which for something like characters or music or sound, anything where there's sort of a time ordering or a spatial ordering of data, they do very well. So if you're not really familiar with how they work on the inside, I'll just briefly review what a convolution is. So suppose that you have some matrix of data. So this would be my image here with my different signal. And what I want to do is I want to convolve this matrix with this particular kernel. So this is a 3 by 3 kernel. And if you see, everything is 0 in this case, except for the upper left and the bottom right diagonal. And so this is a 4 and a minus 4. And what you do is you just apply this kernel as a mask over the data, and you're just going to multiply it element by element. So that's what I'm doing here. Sum the results, and then I'm going to write down the number for that particular case there. And then what I do is I then raster this thing across, and I can take different what are called strides. So if you take a stride one, then I would sort of ratchet this across one. If you take a higher stride, then your output matrix will be of smaller size than your input. But that's basically what a convolution is. And so convolutions show up all over the place in signal processing. But just to give you sort of a sense of what they look like in practice, so this is a picture that I took once upon a time. And back in the early days of Photoshop, before Instagram, you could actually define what kind of moves or filters or blurs or whatever that you were going to do on your images by defining what the convolutional kernel was. And it's probably buried somewhere in Photoshop still that you can do this. But just to give you an example, so if I take this image on the left and then I apply this kernel to it, this is my output image. And if I were to apply a different kernel to it, I get a different, what's called feature map. And so if you've done much numerical work, you can kind of say, oh, this thing's kind of useful because it's gonna be able to calculate things like derivatives or pick up on edges and so forth. So what we wanted to do is we said, okay, well, clearly there's this analogy here between what density functional theory aims to do and what the computer vision and the machine learning community has already accomplished in things like MNIST. So can we build a box that takes the electron cloud and maps it rather than to sort of like handwritten digits, can we map it to physical observables? Can we sort of get something like a non-interacting kinetic energy, forces, and so on? And so if you think about it for a minute and you're sort of from this field, you say, well, wait a minute, that's actually just a functional itself. What you're proposing to do is a machine learning functional. And so, yes, I agree with you. And we are not the only ones who are trying to do this. So I would say the kind of the earlier, the pioneering work in using sort of neural networks with DFT was probably Baylor and Parinello. There they weren't really doing a density functional, but they were saying, can we do a mapping between some configuration of atoms to an energy, right? So you're not working on a charge density in this case. And then followed by that, a couple years later, a team sort of, Robert Mueller and Kieron Burke realized that it might actually be possible to start to predict the charge density itself. So here they, in this initial work, they sort of did simple one-dimensional systems as sort of a proof of principle. And then more recently, they showed that for molecular systems, you can sort of learn what they call the HK map itself. So this is this diagonal here. So we're going directly from potential to a density, bypassing the equations. And so we wanted to do something along this vein, but we wanted to make sure that we had something that was very general and flexible. So we didn't want to just fit to a particular molecule. So in that case, they were focused on water. We wanted something that you could sort of apply on any possible system. And importantly, we wanted to make sure that there was no feature engineering so that we could actually sort of make sure, use of all the developments that you have in deep learning. And so invariably, you're going to have this question of, okay, so you want to develop a functional, so what data are you going to use? Where are you going to get your data for in this case? And so the world that I live in, it kind of bridges two communities of physics and chemistry. And so we have to make sure that we can kind of, we have data sets that work both ways. So physicists are really a big fan of the uniform electron gas. This is something that we can kind of feel good about. And in some cases, we're willing to consider higher densities of the uniform electron gas. And so I'll just very quickly introduce some notation here. So the Wigner-Seitz radius is a term that's used in solid state to describe the density of electrons. And it's basically something where, if you're not familiar with this, it's sort of, imagine that you put a whole bunch of electrons in a box. And so they're within some fixed volume. The Wigner-Seitz radius is basically what the radius of the spheres would be of these electrons packing with one another, and divided by the Bohr radius so that it's dimensionless. And so it's a very useful parameter. It gives you a natural length scale of the electron gas. And the sort of the important limits are as follows. So RS, as it's typically called, if RS is a big number, then you have a very low density system. And if RS is a small number, so much less than one, then it's a high density system. And so back to this question of where do you get the data, there is a very famous paper from the 1980s by Bernie Alder and David Sepperly, where they said, well, why don't we use a numerical method, quantum Monte Carlo, to exactly calculate, or exactly estimate, I guess you would say numerically, what the total energy is for the homogeneous electron gas to the best of what they could do as a function of density. And so they looked at the very dilute limit, so this is RS100 over on the right, and then they considered it to down to about RS of 1. And so these are what those blue points are there. And in that paper, they actually looked at a couple different phases. It turns out that the electron gas goes through what's called a Wigner crystallization at low density. But this is for a particular phase of the gas. And you can immediately see that there's clearly some sort of simple pattern here that you could do different fits to. So people have come up immediately with different fit functions that come from this, some of which are sort of simpler than others. So this was the original fit that came out following that year. Things got a little bit simpler. This has started kind of looking like feature engineering. And then actually most recently in 2016, it was shown that you can get a very good match with this data, not by fitting it, but by actually solving, perturbatively using Mohler plus a perturbation theory. So that's not a fit, but an overlay. And so this is now our parameterization of the correlation energy for the electron gas, which is what we need if we're going to use density functional theory. So in the sort of the early 1980s, the most popular density functional, and this is probably where it got a bad rap. So I can already tell there's people in the room who are sort of scouring at me saying, oh, density functional theory fails in all these different ways. It's probably because your supervisor heard of this thing. So this is, if you take this sort of functional, which has been parameterized on the free electron gas, you can imagine that it's going to do pretty well in some cases, like a simple metal, like lithium. But then in other cases where there's sort of like strong correlations or where you have sort of high degrees of localization, it's not going to do particularly well. But it's the simplest one, and so this is where I wanted to start. So it's called the LDA, or the LSDA sometimes, which means the spin density approximation. And it's actually a relatively simple thing to look at. Basically, what you do is you say, I'm going to say that the exchange correlation energy, so the contribution of the energy, which is coming from this fictitious external potential or effective potential, is something that I can literally just integrate across. So imagine that you have, so here's your density, I've just gridded it up to make it clear. And all that you do is you say, I'm going to collect the value of the density at this point, I'm going to pass it into this EXC thing here, which we've parameterized against the quantum Monte Carlo data, right? So you just pull some value from the curve there. We multiply it by the density at that point, and I just sum it up. And I'm gonna move across the grid like this, and I'm just gonna integrate. This is our way of doing a functional, right? It's sort of the zeroth order functional. It turns out if you do this, like I said, you can actually do pretty well across a surprising number of materials. So you can get things like atomization energies, bond lengths to within something like 2%. You can recover the band structure of a whole bunch of simple metals. It's surprisingly good. And so then one can then immediately say, well, wait a minute, you're only looking in this very local region. Can we do something? What about if we have an electron gas which is not completely flat? Because we know that this isn't necessarily true. And people said, well, why don't we consider gradients? Let's look at sort of electron gas that has some wiggles associated. And so that would mean that we'd have to, when we do our integration, we'd have to include some local gradient information. And so you can start to raster this thing across and sum up the contribution. And at this point, you should be thinking, oh, that's interesting. This kind of reminds me of a convolution. Okay, so that's one limit that you can exist with. That we'll call, those are the kind of the physics limit of the electron gas. What about chemistry? So in chemistry, people are often interested in complexes where electrons are much more localized, right? So this is just an example of some work that we did in the group before. And what we're showing here, so this is a transition metal that has undergone some optical excitation. And what we have is we're actually moving charge from the center region out to the wings over here. So this is the sort of the initial, and then the final, this is the difference in what we're getting in terms of the charge. And you can see that this electron density here is anything but delocalized. This is not a metal. And so unsurprisingly, when you have parameterizations that sort of assume a uniform gas, it doesn't do very well. And so this is where you get this term, or this very popular functional, which you if you've met a chemist, or you know someone who pretends to be one, like me, You've heard of this acronym. So this is called the B3 LIP, okay? And what it is, so this was a, there was a series of papers in the early 90s which developed this functional, and it's what's called a hybrid functional. And so it mixes in a portion of what's called exact exchange, which I'm not gonna go into, which basically deals with the self-energy, which is introduced by the Hartree energy within the system. And so the thing that I wanna sort of draw your attention to here is not this full form, but specifically these coefficients. So the three in the B3, so B is someone's name, the LIP is other people's name, but the three means that there are three fitting parameters within this functional. So A0, AX, and AC. And these parameters have actually been fit to a data set. The funny thing about DFT is people like to call it an ab initio method, and we like to say it's, you know, it's not based on any semi-empiricism, but I would actually argue that, you know, both the LDA and B3 LIP are actually machine learned potentials. So before we all learned the word machine learning, we used this term called fitting. And that's what B3 LIP is. And it's actually fit to a particular molecular data set called the G1 data set. And I don't want to be disparaging here. So these are not arbitrary fitting parameters. So Becca has, you know, good physical reasons for each one of the terms. But if you were to put this into the language of machine learning, you would say that he did feature engineering. He found a data set, he did regression, and then he used the G1 as his test set, and then the rest of chemistry, or training set, and the rest of chemistry is his test set. This is how you would frame it in terms of a machine learning language. And as you can imagine, molecules which are close to his training set, the G1, do really, really well. And as you get far away from that space into the test set, it does poorly. So things like metals, it does poorly. And there's a wonderful graphic by Peter Elliott, which has sort of showed the explosions of acronyms in DFT. This is kind of what we're seeing now in the ML and AI community with the explosions of models, right? If you want to have a model that can predict cats and dogs, okay, you know, Google will sell you that one. But if you want to have something that can predict sort of different types of, I don't know, whiskey. I don't know why I'm thinking of whiskey, but I guess it was a rough night. There's a different model for that. So you get this sort of model zoos, and I would say that's kind of what we had in DFT, a zoo of models, where people will often ask, well, what's the best functional? What's the thing I should use? And the answer is, well, there isn't a best functional. There is a bias which is introduced either by the ansatz, right, so in the form that we're going to break this thing down, or in the training set, or, you know, most often both. Okay, so what did we do? So what we said is we want to start to revisit some of these early parameterizations, but we want to use the technology of deep learning. And so we said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to generate a training set, and we're just going to kind of play around and explore. And so we said, well, fine, you need to have an external potential. So we started off with the simple harmonic oscillator, because somehow it feels like if you don't have that, you know, how can anything be correct? And then we went on and we said, okay, let's make it more challenging, where we said we're going to make what will have a random external potential. So this would be some complicated quantum dot or something like this. And when you're generating this kind of data, you have to make sure as well, you know, random can be dangerous and unphysical. So we had to make sure that our random potentials are not too deep. If you make them too deep and things too sharp, basically you've just made a simple harmonic oscillator with a lot of window dressing around it. So we create a set of external potentials, which are going to give rise to interesting and a unique set of data. I really like 2D stuff because it's easy to make pictures of it. And I really like grids because it's really easy to map all this stuff onto the image thing. So what I'm showing you here is 2D and grids, but the idea worked for continuous convolutions and it works in 3D, of course. So what we do, so we use a DFT package called Octopus, which can solve DFT in real space. And just to give you an idea of what the data set looks like, so here is a particular external potential, sort of shown in the top here. And so this is going to be the input to our electronic structure calculation. And then, of course, the other input that you need to decide on is, well, how many electrons are there in my system, right? Obviously, the charge density depends on that. So this is an example of the resulting charge density, shown with this sort of fancy projection plot that Kevin can make. And I don't know how to make any more because I'm a PI now. This is the case that you get for a 10 electron system. And so Kevin, bless his heart, did many of these projections and many calculations. And so just to give you a sample that we have in this data set, so we look at 1, 2, 3, and 10 electron systems for a simple harmonic oscillator. And then we do the same type of thing for these random external potentials. And somewhat embarrassingly, we do this 300,000 times for each one of these potentials. And the reason that we do it so many times is because I wanted this to be a reference data set. I want this to be a data set that people will be able to play with into the future, and you can have no questions about whether or not you had enough data or you didn't have enough time to do the engineering. So just to give you, when you sum up all those numbers, what do you get? You get 2.4 million DFT calculations, which have been done for varying number of electrons, varying number of functionals, and both trivial and interesting external functionals. These are 2D. A 2D reference set is so useful right now because you can play a lot with network architectures and it works on the current cards. In 10 years' time, when NVIDIA's cards have more RAM, we'll do a 3D one. But right now, if you play with 3D, it's just it's so long to get anything to converge, it's not helpful. That's the reason. So just to tell you a little bit more about this, because we really want people to use this thing, we've put considerable effort into making this thing available to people. So it's staged on Google Drive. We have scripts to download it directly into Compute Canada, or if you're using a DOE machine. And we've done lots of testing and bandwidth, so you can get transfers 100 megs a second from the place that we're staging this on the internet. And it's about a terabyte of data, and it's all been set up in HDF5, so it's really easy to work with Jupyter Notebooks and this kind of stuff. So please use it and play around with it. Okay, so what did we do with it? So we did a couple things. So one of the things that we did is we say, well, can we actually learn the functional itself? So a functional is something that takes some argument rho, right? So this is the charge density here on the left-hand side. And we're gonna pass it into a neural network. And rather than predict, you know, just one answer, so the total energy, we actually found that you can do something called cooperative learning, so where you predict multiple properties simultaneously. And cooperative learning has actually been shown to be something that can accelerate learning. So, you know, if you have multi-class labels, multiple labels per class, actually learning simultaneously on all the labels can actually assist in learning relative to doing models for individual ones. And so this is kind of cool because you can actually predict the non-interacting kinetic energy directly from the charge density, which is something that lets you do orbital-free DFT. We also have a mapping to the from the external potential directly to all of these different terms. And we're using something which is a little bit different, which is what we call an EDNN. So I'm gonna do a little brief aside on the topology here, just to explain what we're doing. So an EDNN sort of answers a question which is actually pretty important in physics, which is, or at least in the sort of the AI ML community, which is how do I apply what I learned on small stuff to big stuff? So imagine that you wanna do a DFT calculation. So this is sort of from a previous life where, you know, I've done calculations on stuff like this. Roughly speaking, this is the size of system that you can kind of do on a workstation these days, right? So this is basically, this is like a cadmium telluride lead selenide interface, and where it's got some various functional or various molecules that have been covalently bonded to the surface. The problem is that this calculation is actually only a small portion of what we were actually trying to simulate in the system, which was an interface at a nanorod. And so this is actually, you know, just to go back here, this is what we can do, but this is actually just a small image of what we want to do, right? We want to be able to understand nanostructures that have, you know, potentially millions of atoms. And so you can say, well, maybe what you could do is you could sort of do a calculation on this scale, and then you could do it on the different scales, and you could patch it up somehow. And of course, this creates the problem of like, well, what do you do with the interface between these different calculations? And what we had, so we found a way of solving this. And so I'll do a little aside. So we're gonna do a little thought experiment. We're gonna do some counting here. So what I want you to do is I want you to look at this square or this rectangle here, and I want you to count the number of red dots that you see here. So how many dots are in this picture? And the answer, we won't do one by one, the answer is 18. And then if I take that rectangle and I cut it in half, if I just cleave it right down the middle and I ask the same question, how many dots are on this side? The answer is 9. And how many dots are on this side? The answer is 9. And so importantly, the two subsystems still add after the cleave, right? So the counting operation is something that you can take a system, divide it in half, and the counting operation still works. So counting is both extensive, i.e. the two subsystems add, and it's fully local. You only need information in the direct vicinity to be able to do the counting. Now let's ask another question, which is about neighbors. So how many neighbors does the black dot have in this rectangle? So we can count them together. So it is 1, 2, 3, 4. There are 4 neighbors in the upper panel. And now I'm gonna do this cut operation again, and I'm gonna ask the same question, how many neighbors do we have on the left and the right? And the answer is 3 and 0. So neighbors are something that are physically extensive. However, they don't survive the cut. So there's something else that's going on with neighbors, and it's the fact that it is a semi-local operator. You need some information from the neighborhood in order to properly count. So different operators have different locality length scales, and importantly, these things can be learned. And so what we wanted is a neural net that both understands this and can learn these locality length scales. So what we do is we say, okay, we're gonna take our data and we're gonna replicate it in a particular way so that the net has to learn the idea of locality. So here's an example data that I have in the top. So these are just some binary values. And what we're gonna do is we're gonna expand and replicate this data so that we can learn locality. So I want you to focus on the red square up here. What we do is we take this red square and I'm gonna extract the data that has a context of 1 around the red square. So this is what I'm showing here. And so you can see, okay, I've grabbed those neighbors. Now I'm gonna move to the next square, the orange square, and I'm gonna do those things. So I'm gonna grab the data, or some data rather, in the vicinity of the orange square, and I'm gonna create another, what we call tile. Then I go to the blue, into the green, and so on. And so for this example here, this 1 4x4 matrix would have 16 tiles, which were associated when we use these two hyperparameters. Now what I'm gonna do is I say, I have some property which is physically extensive, so that means it sums across the subsystem. And that property depends on all of these tiles. So what I do is I say I'm gonna create a net which will simultaneously operate on all of the tiles, and it will use the same weights through each one of these paths. So we weight lock this, 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 and this, and so on. And during inference, you can either do this in parallel or you can do it in series, but you're going to apply the net on this tile, and this tile, and then sum the answer to get to your final answer. The way that we do the training is the same thing, but just with backprop. So we basically evaluate what the errors are 16 times in this case, for the case of the tiles, and we can just backpropagate through one net. And so this idea, which turns out is pretty simple and kind of obvious after the fact, didn't exist previously, but it works with any topology that you want. So this works with fully connected layers, it works with graphs. This thing can work with any ML algorithm which is differentiable. That's the only requirement. And in fact, the only reason they even need a differentiable is because it's harder to optimize otherwise. You could even do this with something that didn't have gradients if you wanted to. So once you've done this process, you've learned the locality length scale of your system, then you can break it up into the, you know, replicas of that. So we recently had this accepted. We got sort of an alien-like cover on the cover of Chemical Science. This was Kyle's handiwork. I thought it kind of looked like, what do you call it? What's the one with the radio one? War of the Worlds. It kind of looks like a War of the Worlds thing, but this is Kyle's visualization of an extensive deep neural network. And so what does it give you? It gives you order n with scaling size, or with system size. You've got strong linear scaling across nodes. So you can sort of go up to millions of atoms without problems. It has local energy updates. So if you're using something like a Monte Carlo sampling, then you don't have to pay the cost of recomputing your energy every time. And in principle, it can work with any locality or any operator. Because basically what it's doing is it's learning the screening length scales of the system from the data and then taking advantage of it. Okay, so that was a little aside about extensive deep neural networks. And so that's what we use on our data set. And so what we showed is that we can actually train on small areas of our charge density, and then we can predict arbitrarily large ones with order n cost. And we can go from rho to E, and we can go from the external potential to E. So once we make our 3D data set in 10 years and train it on that, this is basically we'll do the exact same thing, where we'll learn the locality length scale based on the data set, we'll be able to patch things up, and then you'll basically have an exact functional. Okay, so how well does it do? So this is a wonderfully busy plot, but the key point of the plot actually is right here, the y-axis scale. So the point here is that the error, so what are we plotting here? So we're plotting the error that you get as a function of energy for different combinations of these potentials and an exchange correlation, potentials and the charge density. But the scale of this plot is a very small number. So this is between negative 0.5 and 0.5 millihartree. So this is a small number, per angstrom squared per electron. And as you can imagine, that as you go to larger number of electrons and you have more complicated functionals, you get a little bit more spread. But the point here is basically the order of magnitude of these errors is small. And there's a sort of a subtle point along this bottom row here, which is we're actually starting to sort of mix and max functionals. So we're saying, can you take a charge density computed at one level of theory and predict it at a higher level theory, and does it work? So the take-home point here is basically that this model, our worst model, so 10 electrons in random external potentials, it's got a mean absolute error, which is basically an order of magnitude base better than what had been done previously. Okay, well, so then what about actually going from something like the potential to the charge density, right? So we know we can get energies, but can we just go from one to the other? And so for this, we sort of lean on the deep learning community. So we found something in NeurIPS from 2015, which is called the Deep Convolutional Inverse Graphics Network. And this basically lets you go from image to image. So they used it as a generative model, so they had a probabilistic hidden cell. In our case, we just feed it the same answer. So that it's deterministic. And so here are the results from these tests. So on the far left, we're showing the external potential, the true charge density, so this is what you're getting from your electronic structure calculation, the predicted value, and then the difference between the two of them. And I'm just going to zoom in on these to give you sort of a sense. So the left, this is the numerically exact answer, as you would say, from DFT. And then the right is what we're getting from our model. And so it takes something like, 50 milliseconds to generate an image like this. Like most of it's actually I/O at this point. And then the image on the left-hand side, this would be sort of like an hour to 2 hours, depending on the details of the calculation. So this works across a broad swath of densities here. And it's not perfect, but it's pretty good. And so then you start to wonder, okay, so we seem to be able to reproduce what's going on with DFT. Can you actually just do better than DFT? Because it's not perfect, right? So just because there's a huge number of citations and people are using it, there's known problems, right? The problems were kind of getting fixed over the years, but it's not a perfect method. And so you can reasonably ask, can we do better than this? And there's been some really interesting work that's come out in the literature recently by Burke and collaborators, where they've proposed something which they call delta DFT. So they say, for small systems, where we have the ability to do much higher level calculations, so couple cluster with singles and double excitations, they say, is it possible to actually just learn a correction to DFT? And so in that work, what they did is they focused on a small molecule, water, and they generated a trajectory, so just sort of a gas phase molecular dynamics using DFT. And what they do is they calculate from individual snapshots. They do a couple cluster. So if you're not aware of this, couple cluster is basically, it's a way of sort of expanding the wave function into different types of excitations, and you get a better variational ansatz, and so then you can get a lower bound on the energy. It's basically considered the gold standard by chemists in terms of electronic structure. So they take these different snapshots, and what they're showing here are for different configurations of the water molecule, the DFT values, so these are the red, sometimes they tend to get a lower energy than the coupled cluster, but in other cases, they get a higher energy. So DFT does not agree perfectly with coupled cluster, which is well known. And so then these are the differences that they're showing here. And so what they do is, using a kernel ridge method, they actually train a model which corrects their DFT to the coupled cluster result. And what I found really interesting about this and sort of exciting is actually, so if you look at these curves, this is sort of how many training samples it takes to, for their model to learn DFT. So it sort of asymptotes out to a certain error, which you can't do better than. This is how many training samples it takes on their coupled cluster to get to learn that model. But actually learning the difference converges very quickly. And so I think this is actually very promising that we'll have the ability to sort of learn corrections to our DFT. So what would that actually mean in practice? There's one problem we have to solve. So this is one of the charge densities we have, and you can imagine the same thing in 3D. Let's just take a line cut just through some arbitrary directions in the space to give you a sense of what are the variations in the charge density that you actually need for something like this. So if you're using the homogeneous electron gas, it's really easy to define what space you want to sample. You just literally change the parameter for the density. And so, you know, going from RS10 to 100, you would have these flat lines in position. We need something that looks more like this, and we need to basically sample over all the different variations. And so in the last 2 minutes, I'm going to give you a little bit of speculation how I think we might be able to do this, which is some recent results that we have on something called conditional GANs. So GANs are a generative model that can learn distributions, and conditional GANs are something that you can basically train with the labels. And what we've recently shown, at least for the case of the Ising model, is that if you provide a conditional GAN with lots of examples of low energy structures and high energy structures with labels, the GAN can actually learn how to produce new samples that you didn't train on that have the same label. And so what we're going to do is we're going to train up a conditional GAN on the density, and this is going to start to propose our new things. This is my like crazy idea, basically, how to sample density space. But this is very speculative. So if people think this is a terrible idea, please come grab me a coffee and tell me why you think it's a bad idea. So, okay, so there where we are. We have a reference data set that I hope people will play with for developing functionals. We can go from the charge density to the energy to the external potential. And then using our EDNNs, we get order n scaling and strong parallelism. So thank you very much.
Okay, we have time for just one question, I think.
So my question is, if machine learned functional is exact, what do you mean by do better than DFT, if you have an exact functional?
What do I mean by do better than DFT?
Yes.
So, I mean, in everything that I talked about, we're still limited somehow in what systems we'll be able to train against. So ideally, you'd be able to, you know, do QMC on all possible variations of density and train against something like that. And in that case, your DFT would hopefully be as good as your QMC. Realistically, I would say in the next, you know, 5 to 20 years, we're still going to be training against small, like basically imperfect data sets. And so our DFT at that level is going to be limited by our data sets, if that makes any sense.
So I have a second question, a very short question. Is the machine learning functional for us in the same category as the designing the functional with an empirical method, as opposed to designing functional with physical constraint?
So I think when people, it probably depends on who you ask. So so if you look at how functionals have sort of been designed historically, people have sort of physical arguments about why there should be certain terms, right? But people also had physical arguments as to why there should be certain terms included in computer vision. There was probably a better basis for the case of the functionals, but like at a high level, I would say both of those things are examples of feature engineering. So I think reasonable people could disagree on this point, but yeah, there's definitely some analogies there between how things were sort of designed traditionally and how people are approaching it now.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, I think we'll leave the rest of the questions for the coffee break. So there's a break now until 10:45. Let's thank Ising again.